Yeah.
Okay, let's go.
Can everybody hear?
Yeah.
You can hear, all right. Because I'm not used to speaking really loud. Well, yeah, but then if you go to simultaneous, I can't have people who can't see you doing simultaneous. Mm-hmm. So, okay, so reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 9th canto, chapter 2, text 29. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So I guess you don't have the verse written. So I'll just have to read. And the next few verses don't have any purport, so I'm going to keep reading until we get to the beginning of the next chapter. All right, so I'll just read the Sanskrit and we'll just go quickly. Marutasya Dhammaputras Tasya Sid Rajavardhanaha Asuratishtatsuto Jakne Chodrite Onarasutaha. Marutas' son was Dhamma, Dhamma's son was Rajavardhana, Rajavardhana's son was Sudriti, and his son was Nara. Text 30. Tatsuta kevalastasmat dunduman vegavamsita udastasya bhavatsit yasya trinavindur mahapitihi. The son of Nara was Kevala, and his son was Dunduman, whose son was Vegavan, Vegavan's son was Buddha, and Buddha's son was Trinabindu, who became the king of the earth. Tambeje lambusha devi vachaniya gunalayam varapsara yata putra kanya chela vilabhavat. The best of the apsaras, the highly qualified girl named Ambalusha, accepted the similarly qualified Trinabindu as her husband. She gave birth to a few sons and a daughter known as Ilavila. Text 32. Yasyam utpadayam asa vishravadanadam sutam prataya vidyam paramam rishir yugeshvara pituhu. After the great saint Vishrava, the master of mystic yoga, received absolute knowledge from his father, he begot in the womb of Ilavila, the great celebrated son known as Kubera, the giver of money. Text 33. Vishala shunya bandushcha dumraketus chitatsutaha vishalo vamsakrit raja vaishalim nirmame purim. Trinabandhu had three sons named Vishala, Shunyabandhu, and Dumraketu. Among these three, Vishala created a dynasty and constructed a palace called Vaishali. Text 34. Hemachandra sutastasya dumrakshastasya chatmajaha tatputrat samyamad asit akrishasva sahadevajaha. The son of Vishala was known as Hemachandra, his son was Dumraksha, and his son was Samyamad. The sons were... whose sons were Devaja and Krishashva. And finally, text 35 to 36. Krishavatsamadattu bhut yosame daridaspatim ishva purusham apagriyam gatim yogeshvarasritam somyadattis tu samvatis tatputro jana mejayaha iteva shala bhupalas Trinabindur Yashodaraha. The son of Krishashva was Samadatta, performed Ashvamedha sacrifices and thus satisfied the Supreme Personality of Godhead Vishnu. By worshipping the Supreme Lord, he achieved the most exalted post of residence on the planet to which great mystic yogis are elevated. The son of Samadatta was Sumati, whose son was Janamajaya. All these kings appeared in the dynasty of Vishala, properly maintained the celebrated position of King Trinabindu. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports of the ninth canto, second chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled The Dynasties of the Sons of Manu. And actually, there's a whole bunch of verses without purports in the next chapter. Let me just read the chapter summary of the next chapter, and then we'll comment if that's all right. Because otherwise, we're just going to be reading verses the whole class. So, chapter 3, which is a very exciting chapter, the marriage of Sukanya and Chaivanamuni. So, Srila Prabhupada explains in the chapter summary, this chapter describes the dynasty of Sarayati, another son of Manu, and also tells about Sukanya and Revati. Devanya Sarayati gave instructions about what to do in the ritualistic ceremony observed on the second day of the Yajna of the Agni Agisaras. One day Sarayati, along with his daughter known as Sukanya, went to the ashram of Chaivanamuni. There Sukanya saw two glowing substances within a hole of earthworms, and by chance she pierced these two glowing substances. As soon as she did this, blood began to ooze from that hole. Consequently, King Sarayati and his companion suffered from constipation and inability to pass urine. When the king asked why circumstances had suddenly changed, he found that Sukanya was the cause of this misfortune. Then they offered all prayers to Chaivanamuni just to satisfy him according to his desire, and Devyagya Sarayati offered his daughter to Chaivanamuni, who was a very old man. When the heavenly physicians, the Ashwini Kumaras, once visited Chaivanamuni, the Muni requested them to give back his youth. These two physicians took Chaivanamuni to a particular lake in which they bathed and regained full youth. After this, Sukanya could not distinguish her husband. She then surrendered unto the Ashwini Kumaras, who were very satisfied with her chastity, and who therefore introduced her again to her husband. Chaivanamuni then engaged King Sarayati in performing Soma Yajna and gave the Ashwini Kumaras the privilege to drink Soma Rasa. The King of Heaven, Lord Indra, became very angry at this, but he could do no harm to Sarayati. Henceforward, the Ashwini Kumara physicians were able to share in the Soma Rasa. Sarayati later had three sons named Uttanavari, Anartha, and Burishena. Anartha had one son whose name was Revata. Revata had 100 sons, of whom the eldest was Kokudmi. Kokudmi was advised by Lord Brahma to offer his beautiful daughter Revati to Balaram, who belongs in the Vishnu Tattva category. After doing this, Kokudmi retired from family life and entered the forest of Vaidarika Ashrama to execute austerities and penances. Okay, so I guess I'll speak about these things. So, Om Ganat Timidandashat Gananjana Shlokaya Chakshur and Meditam Yena Tuzmai Shi Gurave Namaha. So, sometimes the devotees question, why is there so much of this history of dynasties in the Bhagavatam? Because the Bhagavatam is teaching us about pure devotional service, right? I mean, it's called the Paramahansa Sangita. It's not supposed to be dealing with, you know, mundane things. For example, you have the Mahabharata, which does deal to a large extent with many mundane subject matters. And people upon reading the Mahabharata can get confused as to the ultimate goal of life, right? That is why Srila Vyasadeva was chastised by Narada Muni. What happened was that Srila Vyasadeva, and the story is told earlier in the Bhagavatam, that Srila Vyasadeva composed the Mahabharata. Mahabharata means the greater history of India. Bharata is India, the great India. And it's the largest epic story ever. And I forget how many verses it has, but it has over 100,000 verses. And I think it's something like 6 or 8 times larger than the Iliad and the Odyssey. Any of you heard of the Iliad and the Odyssey? No. Some of you have. That's the Western epic poem. you know, it has the gods, you know, the so-called demigods and everything like that. So Vyasadeva had compiled this Mahabharata, and yet he was feeling great dissatisfaction in his heart after having compiled it. And then his spiritual master Narada Muni appeared, and basically his spiritual master chastised the disciple for giving people an excuse to enjoy this material world, right? He said, are you satisfied? Basically, I'm paraphrasing, with encouraging people to identify the body with the self. You know, so that's a very heavy statement to make to the disciple. You know, the disciple spent so much time composing something, and all of a sudden, you know, you say, you know, you really, you're confusing people like this. Because the point is that people will take any excuse for sense gratification, right? Like if you give them, as we say in America, if you give someone an inch, they take a mile. If you give someone a centimeter, they take a kilometer. I remember in the early days in the movement, one time, Srila Prabhupada took a beverage named 7-Up. Have anyone heard of this beverage? It's a very popular beverage. So Prabhupada took this beverage on the plane. They offered it to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada asked, what is it? And they said, lemon, water, a little sugar, a little carbonation. So Prabhupada took the beverage, and he liked it. And then the next day, basically he said, can I have more of that 7-Up? And then within a few days, there was a big truck delivering 7-Up to the temple in New York. You know, one of those big delivery trucks to deliver the soft drinks. So people were just taking any excuse to enjoy themselves. You know, all these Prabhupada says stories, half of them are about enjoying yourself. So Prabhupada actually said, if someone says that he says something, he didn't say something. You have to actually read it and have a transcript of it. Just like in court, in law court, you have to be able to cite, what's called a citation. If someone has to say where the law is, you can't go into a court as a lawyer and just say, judge, this is not a good law. You have to be able to present some past laws or past judgments that have been passed, you understand. So anyway, so Srila Vyasadeva was chastised by Narada Muni. And therefore, in order to rectify what he had done, in other words, to point out pure devotional service, he composed the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is called the Paramahansa Samhita. And the Srimad Bhagavatam is also called the Bhagavat Purana, the most important of all the Puranas. Of course, as Prabhupada explained, there's 18 major Puranas, and 6 Puranas are meant for people in different modes of nature. 6 for the mode of goodness, 6 for the mode of passion, and 6 for the mode of ignorance, right? So, one interesting thing about the Puranas that you should understand, because some of the devotees are very enthusiastic to quote different Puranas, and you hear all these wild stories from the Puranas, is that most of them you don't have in their original form, because they've been changed since time immemorial. Just like you see even in the Western world, you have your Bible, and the Bible has been changed since, anyway, that's history, that's Western history. So that most of the Puranas you don't have in the original form, so there's all these stories that came about, and things have been added, things have been subtracted, and things have been changed. So you can't really quote most of the Puranas, at least a Purana that you haven't received in the cyclic succession. And the Srimad Bhagavatam, we have it in our original form, because it was passed down into cyclic succession, right? Ivam parampara praptam imam raja shayo vidahu. So we have faith in the words of the Bhagavatam. It's the original Bhagavatam. Whereas people may quote from the Shiva Purana, or this Purana, or that Purana, but It's really, you don't have it in the original form. You don't know what the Purana originally said, nor do you know what the Mahabharata originally said. There's 80 different editions of the Mahabharata. Did you know that? And some of them are vastly different from other editions of the Mahabharata. I'll give you an example. One example is the story of Vyasadeva's birth. Vyasadeva's father, of course, is Parashara Muni, and his mother was Satyavati. So what happened is, in the Mahabharata that we're most familiar with, that Parashara Muni goes to the bank of the river and he sees this beautiful girl rowing a boat, right? You know the story? And he gets in the boat and says, take me to the other side of the river. And as he's in the boat, he looks at her and says, well, we should have a kid. And she says, this is not such a good idea. I'm a young maiden. And we're in the middle of the river. And then what he does is he creates a fog. And then Vyasadeva is born full grown on an island. Therefore he's called Krishna Dwaipayana Vyasadeva. That's a normal story we're familiar with. But there's another edition of the Mahabharata that is written in South India, where people are much more conservative. They like people to get married first. It's not like Sweden. So in South India, or probably any country in the modern world, in South India, they have the story in their Mahabharata where Parashara Muni and Satyavati get married. There's a fire sacrifice and everything like that, and they bring up little Vyasadeva. So it's a completely different story. Therefore, Madhvacharya, Shripad Madhvacharya, who is our great disciplic predecessor, that means he appeared before in our disciplic succession, he said the Mahabharata has a lot of changes, been changed dramatically. So even in its original form, it really doesn't point out so much directly pure devotional service. You can get really confused. I mean, actually, you read the Mahabharata and you hear about everybody going to heaven at the end of the Mahabharata, right? Anyone here read the Mahabharata? Everybody goes to heaven, even Duryodhana is in heaven. And, of course, Yudhisthira has to see hell first, but after that, they all go to heaven and they join hands and chant Kumbaya, or whatever it is. That's an African song, if you don't know, or It's a Small World. And so they're all back in heaven together. So it's very confusing. So what's the goal of life? If you just read the Mahabharata, I mean, of course, the Gita is there in the Mahabharata. I understand that. But it's a very small part of the Mahabharata, right? It's a very tiny part of the Mahabharata. There are very few verses in the Gita compared to the whole totality of the Mahabharata. So it's very confusing. So the Srimad Bhagavatam only has one topic, which is pure devotional service. Of course, the topic is composed of three different categories, which we call Sambandha, Videha, and Prayojana. Does everyone know what that means? Sambandha means basic information of the tatvas, like who God is, who Krishna is, what the soul is, what the material world is, how the material world was created, etc., what the goal of life is. Those are tattvas. Tattva means basically it's the truth or that which is, precisely in Sanskrit. And then abhideya means what do you do about that information? So we're part and parcel of Krishna, that's a tattva, that's a truth. Krishna is God. Material world is the place of suffering, right? Isn't it? I'm not convinced about that yet. I still think it's nice. But anyway, at least theoretically, it's a place of suffering. these are all truth. It's a place of suffering. We're part and parcel of Krishna. There's a spiritual world where Krishna dances with the gopis. There's a material world where we try to have gopis and dance. Right? Or we try to have imitation Krishnas. That's it. A lady tries to have an imitation of Krishna. So that's a material world. I mean, there's other tattvas too, like there's karma, reincarnation, like the topics that Madhvacharya described in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, the five topics, the jiva, Ishvara, time, the material energy, and karma. So there's five topics. So these are all tattvas. So that's sambandha. And Abhideya is, now that you know these tattvas, what are you going to do about it? I mean, how do you pursue the goal? Because things have a purpose. That's, in philosophy, that's called teleology, that study of purposes. So the purpose is to get out of here, to revive your original spiritual nature. So Abhideya means how to do that. What do I mean? The process of sadhana, bhakti, navabhakti. Navabhakti means the nine processes of devotional service, beginning with shravanam, kirtanam, vishnu smaranam. So that's Abhideya. And then finally, prayojana is what? Does anyone know? Keep everybody awake. What? The goal. The goal. I mean, after you've done your sadhana, what happens? Do you make a lot of money? You know, is that the goal of life? Do you... I mean, what? Do you get a big house, a Mercedes? I mean, what is... Some people think like that. I mean, that's generally what Hinduism is all about. Hinduism is generally about becoming successful in this world. Therefore, Krishna says in the Gita, Trigunya Vishaya Veda, Nish Trigunya Bhavarjuna. That the Vedas are mainly meant for, you know, becoming successful in this world. Trigunya. So, but Prayojana means to achieve the ultimate goal. So those are the three topics in the Bhagavatam. And there's nothing else. So, getting back to the point. So why do we hear all these stories about dynasties? It's an interesting question, isn't it? You know, this person begot this person. Sounds like the Bible. The Bible has similar stories, doesn't it? So-and-so begot so-and-so. Begot means had as a child. That's a fancy old English word. He begot her. Her begot him. I know that's not good English. They begot them. So, all this begotting stuff. Well, I'll try to explain the reasons behind all these things. First of all, many of these dynasties are dynasties in which Krishna appeared or Balaram appeared. Or Lord Ramchandra appeared or Sita appeared. And it's important to establish the history of these dynasties because the Lord generally appears from the Suryavamsa or the Somavamsa. Everybody understands that? Surya means the sun dynasty or the moon. Soma is the moon dynasty. So it's important to establish, because the Lord's family or family tree is extremely important. But apart from that understanding of the Lord's family tree, these dynasties are being explained to show you how the passing of time eradicates everything. Which is really interesting. Like, you hear about all these people who've existed, and they existed in the past, and basically, no one remembers them anymore. Because the time factor is there. So, just like the last part of this introduction to the chapter, it talks about the story of Revata and Kukudmi. So Kukudmi's story is quite interesting. It shows this time factor really well, this particular story, because Kukudmi was looking for he was looking for a husband for his daughter, and he couldn't find anyone qualified. Because in the Vedic system, it's one of the most important things for the father to find a husband for his daughter. I mean, Prabhupada talks about this very much. So anyway, so he's looking all over the place. Finally, he goes to Brahmaloka to try to find out if Lord Brahma has anyone suitable for his daughter. His daughter is highly qualified. And so he sits outside, knocks on Lord Brahma's door, and he has to sit in the waiting room, basically, while Lord Brahma is doing something, watching some dancing performance. And he waits for a few moments. Lord Brahma comes out. Kukudmi asks him, I'm looking for a husband for my daughter. And Lord Brahma says, well, I've got news for you. Everybody that you knew, and everybody who knew them, and all their descendants, and everybody else has passed away, because one moment in Lord Brahma's abode is equivalent to uncountable years of this earth planet. And it was longer than a moment. One instant is like 1 year, like we found out when Lord Brahma had stolen the calves and the cowherd boys. And then he thought about it for an instant, and then he came back and he found, and it was a year later. You know that story in the Krishna book? But in this particular case, it was a little longer than that. And so he said, Lord Brahma said, you better get out of here and go back to the earth planet immediately, because Lord Balaram is there. You can get your daughter married to Lord Balaram. So that's an instance of showing people about this time factor, how things are just like destroyed. As Krishna says in the Gita, this is another thing, lesson we hear from the Gita, that Krishna says, time I am, kalo asmi. And I've come to engage and destroy everyone. So this is a very important thing for us to understand. Hearing the dynasties teaches us this particular lesson. And hearing about the stories within the dynasties, how people try to enjoy material happiness and are relatively or ultimately unsuccessful at it, also dissuades us from our attempt to enjoy material happiness. There's many stories about this. I mean, this is one of the stories here, this particular chapter, Sukanya and Chaivana Muni. Many things we can learn from the story. First of all, Sukanya's chastity to Chaivana Muni. Sukanya, as described here, she was a very young girl, like 14 or 15 or 16 years old, and she was told by her father to marry this guy who was like 80 years old. You know, he was an old... Can you imagine that? Like, if you tell any of you young ladies, you know, here's this 80-year-old man. And, you know, 80-year-old people, they have a lot of wrinkles on them, and they don't look so attractive, right? Even we experience, you know, we get to be... I'm 60-something years old. You look in the mirror and say, oh my God, what's happening? You know, we need some plastic surgery. So, right? I think you still look young, Maharaj. You look like...
I also look myself in the mirror.
you look like the day when I first saw you, like 30 years ago or something like that. There must be something about the atmosphere here that keeps you young. So, you know, Prabhupada said if one travels a lot, it ages one very quickly. So she was told to marry this 80-year-old man. And not only was he 80 years old, another thing that happens when you get to be 80 years old, you get a little cranky. You know what that means?
Mm-hmm.
Cranky means you have a short temper. Right? What's the word in Swedish?
Vreyase. Gaggy.
Cranky, yeah. So that means that if someone says something to you, you just bite them, practically speaking. Right? It's like, you ever experienced that? You say something to someone the wrong way. It's like living with a crocodile, practically. So she was told to marry, and she just... And this shows chastity, too. And she remained married to him and served him nicely in spite of him being so cranky or whatever you call gaggy or whatever the word is. And then, of course, what happened ultimately, she got to be with... He turned young because the Ashwini Kumaras enabled him to be young. But the main point is that she remained faithful to him. And because of that faithfulness, and this is not something just mundane, Because of that faithfulness, she got her reward, which was to have a young husband. Now, it's not necessarily a reward to have a young husband. But if we remain faithful, that principle of chastity and faithfulness, faithfulness to our to Krishna, and faithfulness to the spiritual master, faithful to the devotees, faithful to the process of devotional service, then we also get our reward, too. Hmm. Krishna talks about this faithfulness. He says, if one is not faithful, Ashradanana Purusha Dharma Shasha Parantapa Aprapyamam Nivartante Mritu Samsara Vartmani, he returns to birth and death in this material world. So that's another lesson we're learning from this story here. That story of Sukanya and Sarayati, of being faithful. So all these different lessons, there's many different levels that one can understand the Srimad Bhagavatam on. But they're all lessons, practical lessons for us in developing our Krishna consciousness. Every single aspect, word, paragraph of Srimad Bhagavatam has a purpose to it. It is not simply some story. You know, some just like fairy tale story, or even if it's real, but it has a purpose to bring us closer to Krishna. So that ultimately, when we get to the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, that's Prayojana, we can understand the intimate pastimes of Krishna. But until one comes to the point of being freed from anarthas, or coming to the point of freed from, as Prabhupada says, sex desire, one cannot understand the intimate loving exchanges of Radha and Krishna. So it is all arranged like that. So we shouldn't question why we have to hear about these different dynasties, because there is a purpose behind them. And I'm sure there's more purposes, too, that I haven't even mentioned or thought about. So, any questions or comments? Oh, the children ran away. Don't be too philosophical. Any questions or comments? There's not much more I have to say about this. I mean, read the chapter summary and some of the verses. Questions? Comments? Yeah.
I have one question about this dynasties.
About what?
About the descriptions of the
dynasties.
Dynasties. It seems that there's some emphasis and importance in maintaining the seminal succession.
Yeah.
Even though that sounds really mundane, like our parampara is six of parampara is not. Even if it's a parampara to speak of, a seminal parampara. So, is there still some point, like in the early ages, to preserve some sort of genetic purity or whatever it is?
Yeah, that's another very important point, relating to Varnashram, of course, that the kings were bred. You understand the word breeding? It's like genetic engineering, but without the test tubes and microscopes and everything like that. It was very much considered when arranging for marriages, these genes, you know, who would have good genes, so you would have the proper person born of the family. So that, yes, that's very important. That's another idea of this dynasties, because marriages were arranged, and sometimes there were love marriages. Like in the case of Shantanu and Ganga Devi. That worked out, I don't know if you could say worked out all right. There were problems. A lot of problems. But ultimately it worked out all right, because that was Krishna's plan. But sometimes there's different types of marriages according to the Vedic system. There's love marriages, the Rakshasa marriages, the Gandharva marriages, and the normal marriage that we experience, you know, the Vivaha Yagya, where you get people married. Like the Gandharva marriage, people would just exchange garlands. You'd meet the girl, and you say, we should be married. Just like the story of Urvasi and Pururva. You know that story? And that was another one that was a problematic marriage. Urvasi and Pururva, they just met each other. Of course, she had been cursed to come down to the earth planet. That's another story. And they just exchanged garlands. And she said, I will marry you only under the condition that I never see you naked, that you only give me food with ghee, and you take care of my little pets. She had some lambs. You know what a lamb is? Anyway, it's an animal. So she had, you have some lambs. So what happened is that she lived with him for some time, and the Gandharvas were being sent by Indra, wanted to bring her back to the heavenly planets. And so they came, you know, flying in the sky with a spotlight, and they stole the lambs. Then she got very angry, and Puruva ran out to bring back the lambs to her. And the Gandharvas shone the spotlight on him, and he was completely naked. And so she left. And then he spent the rest of his life basically looking for her again. He found her once, then she agreed once a year she would meet with him. And then after a while, he just started to perform a sacrifice so he could go back to home, back to Urvasi. So anyway, that was the example of a Gandharva marriage. And Rakshasa marriage, the example of that is when Krishna kidnapped Rukmini. That's Rakshasa style, when you kidnap your wife. It's very romantic, isn't it? Just like in the tradition, the Hindu tradition of marriages, usually the red dot is put in the wife's hair part. You seen that? And that's the blood of the husband's enemies when he was fighting to get his wife. So that's it. That's very romantic, isn't it? It is, for a Kshatriya. For a Brahmin, it's not. For a Kshatriya, it's actually quite romantic. My husband fought to get me, he won me. And then you remember that the rest of your life. How heroic your husband was and how he really wanted you. He was ready to risk death just to have you. Isn't that wonderful? Yes. So generally the Kshatriya marriages were arranged so they could come out with good progeny. So there was genetic considerations there. And a lot of these descriptions are there to prove that, you know, the breeding of these particular individuals, and especially the history, the genetic history, even of Krishna or Balaram, which is interesting. Of course, Krishna doesn't have a material body. So is that all right? Yeah. And other questions? Yeah. Prayojana, yeah.
And it sounded a little bit like Sambandha. You get to understand the concept of Krishna and all of us. And Prayojana, you get to understand exactly what happens. But the Abhideya feature, is that a description of the process, or is that also kind of directly about Krishna?
It's about Krishna. I mean, hearing, chanting, remembering, worshiping, you know, serving, that's all about Krishna.
Yeah.
But before you can do that, you have to understand who Krishna is, who you are, what the material energy, what karma is, what the modes of nature are, and all those other things. It's a prerequisite. I mean, it's necessary to understand Sambandha before you have Abhideya. I mean, these things have to be to go in sequence. Otherwise, you'll never reach Prayojana. I mean, if you don't have that tattva understanding, then you could easily end up as a sahaja. Like if you're presented with the intimate loving exchange of Radha and Krishna, and you don't understand you're not the body, then you're going to think, well, Radharani and Krishna are embracing just like I do. Just like I like to go dance, what's a South American dance? A rumba or something like that? You don't know those things. Anyway, there's some dances. You don't have dances here in Sweden. No. It's a very conservative culture. Anyway, there's some dances, mundane dances, so you'll just equate that with, in other words, think it's equal to what Krishna is doing. And so that's called sahaja, to take things very easily or very cheaply. So the tattva understanding is extremely important. And then the understanding of Abhideya how to execute or to cultivate the goal of life is very understanding. Otherwise, you'll never reach prayojana.
So then, sometimes we have classes and we have, the ideas are developed more strongly on how to, what not to do, what the risks are, what the process is. Mm. So that is the Abhideya.
That's Abhideya, yeah.
And then that's the Bhagavatam, so that's equally Krishna. So we hear about these things.
That's equally Krishna, yeah. Equally Krishna, like Bhagavad Gita, the basic information of Bhagavad Gita is equally Krishna. Krishna Katas, the words of Krishna, the philosophy of Krishna, the instructions on how to serve Krishna, the pastimes of Krishna, descriptions of Krishna, descriptions of the process of devotional service, these are all non-different than Krishna. When recited by a actual devotee of Krishna. Because when you hear these things from someone who is not a devotee of Krishna, it can poison your consciousness. What is that statement? That Vaishnava Makod Mikirnam Putam Hadikatam Ritam Shravana Naiva Kartavyam Sarpochisti Atapam. When you hear about Krishna from someone who is not Krishna conscious, it's like taking milk touched by the lips of a serpent. So one has to be very careful who they hear about Krishna from. So the Sambandha Abhideya Prayojana has to be heard from the person Bhagavad. That's why Prabhupada talks in here in the Bhagavatam about the person in the book Bhagavad. Otherwise it will not be effective in helping one advance in spiritual life. So, yeah, more questions. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, Abhideya means the process of bhakti. Basically, beginning with the dosh shraddha tata sadhusa, you know this verse? Tata sadhusa gota bhajana. In the beginning, there's a little faith in the scriptures, and then there's sadhusa gota. Then you begin to associate with the sadhus. Then you begin to execute the process of bhakti, bhajana kriya. And then the anarthas become gradually dissipated. I mean, there's a whole analysis of anarthas given by Vishwanatha Chakrabarti and Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Anarthas come from four different sources. Anarthas come from past, from pious activities, from sinful activities. They come from offenses, and they come from bhakti. Did you know anarthas come from the process of bhakti, if one's not careful? The byproducts. For example, the anartha of pride can come when one becomes spiritually advanced, one becomes proud of that because people start praising it. Those people who are at the position of sannyasi or guru in the movement have experienced that, isn't it? Like people praise you. You get a book written about you every year. Isn't that nice? I mean, every year you get something called a Vyasa Puja book, which is all about you. I mean, it's better than being a kid and having a birthday party. Right? I mean, the birthday parties are all about them, right? You know, it's your fifth birthday or tenth birthday or something. So, we sannyasi gurus, whatever, get to have people praise us. And a whole meal cooked for us and people fanning us. It's interesting. And even the sannyasis in ISKCON get the name Maharaj, which is the king's name. It's not even a sannyasi name. Did you know that? Maharaj means great passionate one. Big passion. Or big king. You know, Raj means king and also means passion. So it's interesting that the title Maharaj was never used for sannyasis before Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Before that, the sannyasis were always called Swami, Goswami, or Babaji, or whatever, something like that. But Maharaj, that's a king's title. So when you get all these things, after a while, it goes to your head. And you begin to think, I'm a Maharaj. And I'm a pure devotee because all my disciples told me I'm a pure devotee. Right? And then you get plenty of anarthas. That's an anartha. So that's why anarthas are caused by bhakti, They're caused by pious activities, impious activities, and of course offenses against Vaishnavas, offenses against devotees. So, yeah, so this is all part of Abhideya. And then, of course, Anartha Nivritti Shad, and then after Anartha you become getting rid of the Anarthas, more or less getting rid of the Anarthas. That's what people ask the question, why does Bhagavatam say that the Anarthas become diminished almost to nil? That's a question people ask all the time, yeah. That, you know, we have that verse, isn't it? By hearing from the Srimad Bhagavatam, then one's Anarthas become diminished almost to nil. You ever hear that before? And you question, almost to nil? You think, why is it almost to nil? Well, the point is, you don't get rid of the Anarthas absolutely until you reach prema. You may get rid of them, but it's not absolutely getting rid of them. And what do I mean by that? Absolutely means there's no chance of coming back. You can get rid of something and it may come back. You can be free of something that may come back, or you can be free of something and it can never come back. There's a difference between the two. Nasta prayeshu abhidreshu nityam bhagavata sevya, right? In that particular verse. So then one becomes, after getting rid of most of the anarthas, one gets steady in devotional service. Nishta, it's called. Then after that, one gets ruchi. You know that whole progress there. You know about it? Ruchi, ashakti, and then bhava, and ultimately prema. So this is all under the jurisdiction of Abhideya, the progress in devotional service. So prayojana basically means reaching the perfection or being involved in the perfection. So Bhagavatam only deals with those three subject matters, whereas the Mahabharata deals with other subject matters. It deals with, it has many instructions. Not that the Mahabharata instructions are useless. There's a lot of stuff there that's useful for Varnashram, for engaging people in this world. Like if you read Grandfather Bhishma's instructions on the bed of arrows. Has anyone ever read that? You read that. When Grandfather Bhishma is lying on the bed of arrows and he's talking to Yudhisthira Maharaj, there's a lot of good practical instructions, you know, how to be a king, how to manage things, how to deal with people, how to make friends, get rid of your enemies, all that other nice stuff. But it's not exactly pure devotional service. It's just practical dealings in this world. So the instructions in the Mahabharata can be utilized in the execution of bhakti, but they're not part of the, but most of them are not part of the sambandha abhideya prayojana process. Whereas everything in the Bhagavatam is, there's no mundane thing here. Mundane people are being described sometimes, but to help us understand how important it is to get out of the material world. Just like Paranjana's story, it's a story about someone who is mundane, right? Paranjana? You don't know Paranjana. It's in the fourth canto of Bhagavatam. This whole story is about it's a story about someone who's mundane, and then anyway, so it's also a metaphorical story on different levels. Any other questions? I've been a little philosophical in class. Yeah. What does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita about four types of people who approach him? Does anyone know? We're going to ask some Bhagavad Gita questions. Chaturvedava Jantimam. Four types of people approach Krishna. Those who are looking for wealth, those who are inquisitive, those who are in distress, and those who want knowledge, right? So, in the beginning stage of devotional service, and even in the advanced stage of devotional service, we want to get, forgive the word, I'm not going to use a bad word, yeah, I'll use it. We want to get the hell out of here. Because it's pretty miserable here. And so, you know, we have that desire, and that desire should be encouraged. Prabhupada actually said that Prabhupada said you should want to go back to Godhead. You should want to get out of this material world. So it's not that you have to push aside that desire to go to the spiritual world. It's actually a very good desire. It's a good impetus to become Krishna conscious. However, naturally, as you progress with that desire of going back to the spiritual world, the desire to please Krishna under any situation will increase in your heart. And naturally, the desire for self-liberation or self-transference to the spiritual world will not be as significant. So you don't have to push it aside. So the question is, should you push a desire aside? No, it doesn't work like that. It's like negating something. And it's actually quite artificial. It's very artificial. To do a negative is impossible anyway. To say, I shouldn't want to go back to the spiritual world. I shouldn't want to go back to the spiritual world. I shouldn't want to go back to the spiritual world. And then you start to feel guilty. But I do. And then you have all this guilt. Oh, I'm not a good devotee. Because I want to go back to the spiritual world. I want to be with Krishna. And then you just got... And then you develop a schizophrenia type of thing. You know, just like... You know, what am I doing? You know, So the point is that automatically your pure love for Krishna will arise. Whatever your motivation is in the beginning, even like Dhruva Maharaj's motivation, he didn't want to go back to the spiritual world. He wanted a kingdom in this world greater than that of his great-grandfather. But in the end, he said, I was looking for some pieces of broken glass and I found a beautiful gem. So the desire to go back to the spiritual world is a wonderful desire because that will impel you to hear more and more about Krishna's pastimes. And by hearing more and more about Krishna's pastimes, your desire just to give Krishna pleasure and Radha pleasure will develop in the heart. And then your desire to go back to the spiritual world will not be so prominent. And then you come to the point of Narayana Paraksa Renat Kutaschana Bibhuti Swarga Pavarga Narakeshu Apitul Yarta Darshana, that Krishna, wherever you send me, I'm happy to go. But that happens naturally. That happens naturally. We cannot do a negation of especially any spiritual desire. So it's a bona fide desire. You know, devotees can desire the four types of liberation. Not the fifth type. What's the fifth type?
Sayuja.
We do not want to desire merging into the existence of the Lord. We can desire to live on the same planet as the Lord, to associate with the Lord, to have the same physical features as the Lord, like that. But we don't want to merge into the existence of the Lord. But so your desire is great. I wish I desired to go back to the spiritual world. I mean, I pray for that desire one day, isn't it? I just desire to eat nice food in this world, you know. Isn't it traveling everywhere in search of good prasadam? You know, Lord Chaitanya said to Raghunath Das Goswami, Raghunath Das Goswami asked him, I've taken the renounced order of life, and I don't know what my duty is. And so through Swarup Damodar Goswami, Lord Chaitanya gave the instruction to Raghunath Das Goswami, you should not wear fine clothes, you should not eat opulent foodstuffs, but you should think of Radha and Krishna in your heart of hearts continually. That's the instruction for sannyasis. So your desire to go back to the spiritual world is commendable, and just cultivate that desire more and more. Yeah, there's no problem. I wish that was a problem. I mean, that isn't a problem. I wish I had that problem. I wish we all had that problem, isn't it? Who actually wants to go back? Just like that story about, who was that, Tukaram. Tukaram was a great saint from Maharashtra. And he was going back to the spiritual world. Garuda came, the bird, a transcendental bird carrier of Lord Vishnu came, and he said to his wife, you can come with me. And what did she say? He said, no, I have so many things to do here. So he got on the airplane and she waved goodbye to him. So please cultivate that desire. That's very nice. So any other questions or comments?
Back to Jayananda Prabhu's verba about asked question about the breeding.
Yeah, you read about dynasties.
In the previous chapter about
right.
King Sujumna.
Yeah, that was an interesting story.
Yeah. In verse 39.
Yeah.
Previous chapter 1, verse 39.
Yeah.
Prabhupada's comment was Gotrajaya, born of the dynasty.
Yeah. And
there it says, since the Gotra and the dynasty is one, there's no difference between the disciples and the families, which are produced by the seed.
Mm-hmm.
So, what we see in our Krishna consciousness, too, many of our gurukulas are gone now. They have this in Sweden here, you see that. A lot of young kids, and we have a lot of old devotees.
Yeah.
But you know, a lot of our second generation, they're in Stockholm making money, and nothing. But it seems like they're in worship service on the back burner.
So what's the question?
Well, then it's not though. You know, it says here that we bred them, but we didn't breed them properly.
No, there's two things with raising children. It's a very interesting subject matter. There's nature and nurture.
What's that mean?
Nature means, the Gotra stuff. Nurture means what happens after the kid is born. So, I'll give you a practical example from the Shastras. Krishna had a wonderful son one time.
Mm.
Krishna was in the form of a boar. And he lifted the earth planet up. Earth planet is called Bhumi. Bhumi is a great devotee, pure devotee of Krishna. Actually, in South India, they worship Sri and Bhu Devi. That means, Bhu Devi is actually Bhumi, same thing. So, as we know from the Brahma Samhita, Krishna can do anything with any one of his senses or parts of the body. Angani, Yasha, Sakalendri, Indri, Trimanti. So when he lifted up the earth planet with his tusk, he impregnated the earth planet. And as a result, there was a nice little boy born, a nice Gotra, and his name was Son of the Earth. Therefore, Boma was his name. So this Boma, he was a nice kid. But he had some bad association. And so they gave him a second name. What was the second name he had?
Asura.
Bhumasura. So such an interesting story is there that Bhumi said to Krishna, please don't kill our son, I know you kill demons, but he's your son. And then Krishna said to Bhumi, I won't kill him without your permission. But Krishna is so tricky. He is the most tricky person. So when he went to fight with Bhumasura, who did he bring with him?
Satyabhama.
And who was Satyabhama? the Bhumi's expansion of Satyabhama. So he was being attacked by Bhumasura, and Satyabhama said, kill him. So there was an instance of someone, you can't do better as far as your father and mother than Krishna and Bhumi. Or, you know, I don't think you can do better than that. Are any of you better than that here? No? I don't know any better parents. Anyway, so, and there was an instance of bad, so that's called nurture. So nurture, what I'm seeing practically is nurture is more important than nature. I mean, for example, I was not born in a fantastic gotra. My parents didn't, you know, pray to Krishna for me. I don't know if they prayed to anybody. I don't know if they even had faith in God. I don't even think my mother believes in God. So, somehow or other, you know, I was born in the darkness of ignorance, but by the mercy and association of His divine grace, Srila Prabhupada, we're here. You know, that's a miracle. That's really a miracle. I mean, you talk about miracles. Miracle is not producing gold. The miracle is producing Vaishnavas from dirt. Referring to myself, of course. I'm not a Vaishnava, but, you know, at least I'm acting like one. So that's nurture. So we have to question, basically the point I'm making is we have to question, how did we nurture these people or these children? What did we, if the children didn't turn out Krishna conscious, then what did we do wrong? And what should we correct? And what should we do in the future? And, you know, several things you see that, I'm not talking about here because I don't know so much the history here, but I'm talking about in America. You know what? Several things we did wrong were that we tried to force the kids to be Krishna conscious. And the interesting thing about people, children, adults, is that when you force them to do something, usually they do the opposite. Because there's this important need for autonomy that people have. Autonomy means to make your own choices in life. Like when you're raising a child, when the child gets to be two, the child starts to express her or his autonomy. And the parents call that the terrible two stage. You've heard that before? But it's not. It's a wonderful two. Because the child's showing it's an independent, or he or she is an independent entity. Before that, the child was more or less amalgamated with the parents. That means one, practically speaking. Considering or not understanding his or her separate identity. So the point about autonomy is that people want to make their own decisions in life. A person convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. So even yourself, if I say, Yogendra, let's give an example. If I try to force you to do something, if I say, eat this food you're given, I'm real heavy about it, you know, and you're not hungry, and I put a plate of whatever, you know, oat water in front of you. And say, Yogendra, I'm a sannyasi, I'm a senior devotee. Eat it! The more I say, eat it, the more you're going to not want to eat it, the more you're going to hate me, and the more you're going to want to be completely different from me. Right? So, at least in America, we did that with the children. You know, you're an arty, okay? You say to the children, dance! And if you don't dance, you're not going to get sweets or something, or breakfast this morning. It's like one of those Western movies where the cowboys would point the gun at the feet and say, dance, partner. You know, you learn how to dance pretty quickly when someone's shooting at your toes. But the dancing is not enjoyable at that point. Or being in front of the deities becomes traumatic. So there's this thing called post-traumatic stress disorder. Did you ever hear of that before? It's called PTSD. So many of our young people are suffering from PTSD that we inflicted upon them when they were young. So they're experiencing their experience of Krishna consciousness, their autonomy is taken away, People were yelling at them. People considered them to be impediments in their devotional service. You know, shut up, I'm chanting my japa. Or, you know, or the child wants to embrace the mother, and the mother says, "You're muchi." I've seen that. I don't know. I don't think it's happened here, maybe. I can't say for sure about anything here. I'm talking about America. And so that I have to do Didi service. Get away from me, muchi. So how does the child experience that? If you tell the child to get away from you because you're dirty, the child experiences that as a rejection or withholding of affection. And the child connects that to Krishna consciousness. You know, it's not a hard connection to make. You know, it's not a big jump. You know, that's Krishna consciousness. You don't get affection. You're muchi. You know, all these rituals, you know, other things, people get into a lot of rituals. And, you know, with children, rituals are really obnoxious. And then you have to sit through classes where it's just bored to tears. I mean, people ask me about my religious upbringing. Someone asked me the other day, I was in Copenhagen, and they asked me, you know, you must have had a nice religious upbringing and, you know, whatever religion you were. I said, it was excruciatingly painful. I was so bored. And the only reason I made it through, because I had to go every week, and I had Sunday school, and we had to read. I said, the only reason I made it through is because I took the books they were reading from and I put comic books in it. You know, like Superman or something like that. You heard about these things before? Otherwise, it was so boring. I mean, the only prayer I made to God was that it would be over. Seriously, I was sitting through the services and I was praying, my dear God, let this be the last thing he says in class. Let it be over. Let it be over. I mean, sometimes in Bhagavatam class I pray the same, I have to be honest. When someone's giving a long Bhagavatam class, I'm saying, Krishna, you know, he's coming to a conclusion, Krishna, please don't let anyone ask any questions. You know, I have to be honest, you know, I'm not going to try to be something I'm not. So that's the way I experienced religion when I was young. You know, it was just something that was really boring. It wasn't so painful, it was just boring. Well, it was painful because I had to dress up in a certain way, not a dhoti, but I had to wear a tie. You know, here I was, 5 years old, and you know what a tie is? I had to wear a tie and a suit and a jacket and a wool suit, which for children itches their skin. I don't know if you know that. When you're real young, wool is very itchy for children. Now wool is comfortable. I love wool. But from when you're real young, because your skin, you don't have as much hair or something like that, wool, it was extreme. I was like itchy, and I had to sit through my services like that. You know, just like feeling pain and everything all the time and bored. You know, just, that was religion for me. So put it in a Krishna conscious context. You know, they may have to wear dhotis that all their friends will make fun of them for, like that. And then, anyway, so and then the Bhagavatam class is extremely boring for them, even for adults sometimes. And you know, even arti is too long for them. You understand all these things? Like a half hour arti, you know, we like it, or 25 minutes, but for them it's just too long because the span of attention is not there. So there's all the things, either boring or torturing, or their autonomy is taken away from them. And you know, all this talk about, you know, don't be affectionate to your mother, it's just Maya. She's not your body, you're not. And how does a kid understand he's not his body? Is it, you know, you got a 5-year-old kid, you're not your body. She's not your mother. You know, what's. And so the whole thing, I mean, it's lucky that many of our kids are not in mental institutions after all that experience. I mean, we're extremely lucky. I mean, we had so many lawsuits, too, for a variety of reasons. So basically, we have to learn the art of presenting Krishna consciousness, being Krishna conscious, in a loving way with the children and allowing them to take it up voluntarily. Prabhupada said we should not destroy the voluntary spirit in the children. That is, they'll see the adults doing something, and if you're having a good time doing something, they'll copy anyway. Like you had this morning, the kids were running around in a circle. It was very nice. But if you forced them to do it, they wouldn't like it. He said, now you have to run around in a circle. Now you have to do this. So I'm not going to give a whole course on raising children, but I'm just expressing some of the things that we experienced in the beginning days of Krishna consciousness, and then we experienced before we joined the Hare Krishna movement in a different religious process. So it's nurture. I would say nurture is 99%, nature is 1%. So it's not enough that you have garbhan and sanskar and the kid comes out and you think they're going to be like a little Pallad Maharaj or Narada Muni. It's not like that. We all thought like that. In the beginning days of the movement, everyone thought like that. And nurture was neglected. But if one's going to have children, that should be their first priority, taking care of the children. Everything else should come second. Anyway, I think you all understand these things. You learn from your mistakes that we made in ISKCON. So many mistakes we made. So, any other questions?
Yes.
Yeah.
Some children are very lost when they are not treated properly.
They're lost, yeah. They got lost.
Even they die.
Yeah, some people commit suicide. There have been suicides. I mean, it's just like, it's horrendous. Because you can't really... I mean, we were enthusiastic when we first joined the movie. We wanted to force everyone to be a devotee. I even tried to force my father to take up Krishna consciousness. I went home, started preaching like hell to my father and said, "This is your whole life is Maya. You're attached to that body." And what did he do? He actually took one of Prabhupada's books and threw it to the ground or something like that. He got so angry with me. You can't do that with people. But you yourself have to have a good time in Krishna consciousness. Other people will want to be Krishna conscious. They'll have a good time. Everyone wants to have fun. Prabhupada said the business of the temple president is make sure everyone is jolly and eating enough prasadam. And if everyone's jolly, then the children will naturally want to be jolly too. I mean, it's a pretty simple thing. Pretty simple. I mean, I've seen so many traumatized children. I have some second generation disciples who can't wake up early in the morning because their parents force them to wake up early in the morning. And they're good devotees. I say to them, why don't you wake up early in the morning? They said, no, every time I think of 4 o'clock in the morning, I start shaking because it's called post-traumatic stress. Because they were forced to wake up, forced to do deity worship at 4 o'clock in the morning, and the poor kids were tired as anything. I've seen kids like in the old days, they were so tired they would fall face first into their prasadam, or eating the prasadam. So, Krishna consciousness is natural. It's naturally attractive. We have to have faith in the process. We don't have to force the process. Even when dealing with people, adults on the outside, we don't have to force the process. We tell people to chant. Naturally, things happen. The question was, we don't have to force you to become ready to come back to the material world to serve Krishna. Naturally, that desire will arise. But we've tried to force it, not only on children, on adults. You have to become desireless. You have so many desires. You're a rascal. Isn't it? You ever hear that before? You're a rascal. You have a desire to go back to Godhead. You selfish something or other. You should just desire to please Krishna. And then this Krishna consciousness is so heavy. Whew! And then you can't take it after a while. Even adults can't take it after a while. It has to, you know, everybody has to respect it on their own level of spiritual advancement and encourage them. Krishna says that. Don't discourage people, but encourage them to work with the spirit of devotion. You know, for whatever. Akama sarva kama moksha kama dharati. Tivrena bhakti yogini jeta putushampara. When one is free of material desires, full of material desires, desires of liberation, they worship Krishna enthusiastically. And so, anyway, so taking care of children is a very difficult thing, and it has to be a full-time occupation, basically. Those who have children should understand that's their occupation for the next 20 years. Or if they have more children, the next 40 years. Right? I mean, there's no future to our movement unless the children become Krishna conscious. Even religious sociologists state that. Unless you have a second generation or third generation becomes Krishna conscious, your society will not continue. It's finished. So the Krishna conscious movement will be finished. We can't just always have a revolving door where we move new people in, and then those people, after they get burnt out, they move out, and we get a whole new batch. Right? And then we move them out, we initiate a whole new batch, move them out. You understand? It's like a processing plant. So, any other questions? Quick questions? Yeah.
Yes, you were speaking about Mahabharata and you were giving instructions that are useful for Manasharam, and also about how Mahabharata, there are so many different versions, it's difficult to tell what we're talking. So, sometimes we have from Prabhupada, one of the best verses that is Manasharam, and we are trying for that. Isn't Manasharam a very risky project because it's very difficult to know what is right and what is wrong,
but
it's actually
Varnashram.
And isn't it important
that
it puts the bhakti process?
Yeah, well, Prabhupada wanted Daivi Varnashram, not just materialistic Varnashram. But basically, Prabhupada didn't want all the details of Varnashram. I mean, someone recently has been quoting the Manu Samhita at me, and it's so complex that I just want to jump off a cliff when I hear it, you know. You know, the duties of a man, duties of a woman. I mean, if you heard the duties of a woman, you would just like, I don't know what you would do. I mean, it's just too complex, all the different, you know, rules and regulations like that. So in Kali Yuga, basically, Ekon Dharma, as mentioned in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's one Dharma, which is Vaishnava Dharma. But we accept Varnashram insofar as what we do with our bodies and practical activities during the day. Sadhana is for everybody. But what we do with our, let's say, you know, someone's a businessman, he should do business. That's basically Varnashram. And, I was just speaking to someone. Yeah, I was just doing some marriage counseling with someone. And, their spouse, husband, was just like going into depression. And he had so many plans to do this, to do that. And I mentioned you really have to understand someone's varna to engage them. They were thinking that the person needs some psychological help. But I said, no, they just need to be engaged according to their varna. And this person happened to be Shudra by varna. Shudra is not a bad thing. And Shudra just means you need someone to tell you what to do 24 hours a day. You know, you need a master. Some people are, and we have to honestly understand what our varna is. Because some people are not self-motivated. They need someone to say, you know, now it's time to wake up, now it's time to do this, now it's time to do that. Other people, like brahmanas by nature, are self-motivated. They don't have someone telling them what to do. They're more independent. They're self-motivated. If you put them in a room, they'll just study shastra, they'll chant Hare Krishna, they'll do something like that. But if you can really tell what someone's varna is if you put them in a room with a computer on the internet. That's all you got to do. I mean, it's pretty simple. Right? You know, the brahmana will be looking at shastra on his computer. The kshatriya he'll be studying politics, you know, what's the latest thing in the war, you know, war in Afghanistan, war in Iraq, what's this politics, that politics. The Vaishya will be looking at the stock market, the exchange rates, and the Shudra will be just looking at movies. Right? Easy Varnashram test, isn't it? Computer, it's a computerized Varnashram test. You know, 10 minutes I can tell you what Varnashram is like.
The ashrams, I mean the Brahmas is one.
Yeah. Well, the ashrams, that's easier. I mean, the ashram, either you're married, you're a single student, you're married, retired, or you're sannyasi.
But it's more close to the candidate
who wants to be. Yeah, the ashram is the spiritual path, right. So, you know, the brahmacharya is being trained by the spiritual master, the grahastha is raising a nice family in Krishna consciousness, that's supporting the rest of society, because he's the stomach of the Varnashram system. And Vanaprastha is engaged in austerities, or traveling, preaching, sannyasa also, same thing, but without wife.
I thought that the Varnas would relate to it.
Well, the Varnas are very...
Varnas are changing. When one's own life, one can change. So.
That's true. So, but the Varnas are very important, because unless one's mind is fully engaged, then one won't be happy. One can't be Krishna conscious. I mean, even myself, I mean, actually, there's differentiation even within the Varnas. Let's take my Varna, whatever it is, Varna Sanskar. So, let's take my Varna. Like, if you occupy me in something, let's take some. I mean, even there's things I like to do, but if I try to do them all day long, I'd go crazy. Like, I like deity worship. You know, I have my deities with me. But if I did that all day long, you know, I couldn't keep my mind focused. So I need to do something, even within the same varna, I need to do something where my mind is focused on something related with Krishna's service. You know, whether it's preaching or planning out something or analyzing something or studying something. If I don't do that, if you put me doing construction all day long, I mean, if Krishna wants, I'll do construction, but my mind won't be there. Right? My mind will be somewhere else. Or if you may try to make me an artist, first of all, it'll look horrible. I mean, it'd be worse than the children's artwork. But secondly, I mean, the mind wouldn't be there. And I wouldn't be focused. So Varna is extremely important, even if we're a sannyasi. It's important to understand what is your psychophysical nature. Because otherwise, your mind, like Prabhupada said, idle mind is a devil's workshop. So we have to see what will attract our mind 24 hours a day in Krishna's service. I mean, and make adjustment in our lives. Like I like hearing Krishna's pastime, so I listen a lot to, right now I'm listening to the Ramayana. Every day I listen for hours to the Ramayana. Before I go to sleep, I listen to the Ramayana. So that keeps my mind occupied. Well, even while I'm doing deity worship, I have a tape of Krishna's pastimes or Prabhupada's class playing so my mind can be occupied. So the whole idea is to keep one's mind. So Vaimana, Krishna Padara Vindaya. You understand? To focus your mind, Krishna Padara, on Krishna's lotus feet. So whatever you're doing, it has to be in accord. It should be in accordance with one's varna. Otherwise, how can you be Krishna conscious? So I think Varna is extremely important too. Without it, your mind won't be focused.
But the authority, they are not the authorities who can see the Varna. It's quite clear. You know, it's like more easy to.
Yeah, but it's very easy to see the Varna. Just put, like I said, put them in a computer, on a computer on the internet. I mean, the old days there was a different test. You brought him into a room, there was a hammer, there was a sword, a bow, a book, and gold, right? And whatever they were attracted to. Like the Pandavas, they were brought into the kingdom of Virat. No, it wasn't Virat. Was it? Drupada's kingdom, sorry, I got it wrong. Drupada's kingdom. They brought, Drupada didn't know who had won Draupadi. So they were brought into to Drupada's kingdom, and he had all these different implements of the different varnas. And the Pandavas went for what?
Weapons.
The weapons. They just said, wow, look at this bow!
Wow.
Look at, isn't that cool? Look at this sword! And they said, then he understood they were Kshatriyas. It's like we have our tests sometimes with the kids, when the kids, they choose between the book and the money. You have that here? You know, that's samskara, you know. But sometimes, with the children, it's not always accurate, but with an adult, it's accurate. Or some people will come to the temple and say, where's prasadam? And they're not thinking, they'll say, oh, after class. It depends on how you can even hear how people say it, like, oh, we're having Bhagavatam class first, and they'll think, but when is prasadam? Then you understand they're more interested in the prasadam than the Bhagavatam class, just by their words, right? So, I think varnas are not, it's not very hard to understand. If someone, particularly I've seen, if someone is not self-motivated, that means they're Shudra Varna. If they need a master. And if someone likes wealth, generally Vaishya. If someone likes to study, there's Brahmins. If someone likes to boss over other people, they're Kshatriyas. Does that make sense? So, there's one more question, Tazuri.
Yeah, I was confused now by your statement about the Lord Varahadeva and Bhumi Devi. When Varahadeva touched Bhumi Devi, then she remained with child.
Yeah.
In the spiritual world, you're all going down. In the Lord Krishna touches all the gopis, and what about children?
Well, it's not that every time Krishna touches someone they have a child, but the point is that Krishna can utilize any of his senses to do anything. Like Prabhupada said, Krishna can taste with his ears. He can eat with his ears. Krishna can smell with his hands. His senses are interchangeable. So when he desires to use a particular sense for a particular activity, that is done, but not that every time Krishna, don't let Krishna touch me. No, it's not that every time, it's not that every time Krishna touches anyone, any lady, they have a child.
Is it in material?
But it's when he wants it. Yeah, that Krishna can do anything he wants, materially or spiritually. Krishna has a spiritual body. And those spiritual bodies don't act under the same laws of nature, the limitations that our bodies act under. That's all. I mean, it's a different thing. I mean, Krishna wanted Bhumi to have a child. But if he didn't want it, he could have just lifted her up and that would have been the end of the story.
That's what I wanted to
hear. Yeah, it's not that every time...
It was Krishna's desire.
Yeah, it was Krishna's desire. It's not that every time anything touches Krishna, you know, you got to watch out for Krishna, you know.
Yeah.
Right? No, but it was Krishna's desire. This Prabhupada tells that story. And little Bhauma was born, cute little kid. The reason I told the story is because it was by association he became Bhaumasura. So, another point is, by association, we can also become asuras too, by bad association. So therefore, Lord Chaitanya says, a satsanga chag, a Vaishnava char. A Vaishnava should avoid bad association. And by good association, we become pure devotees too. Sarasanga. Sarasastra koi. Mabamatra sarasanga. Sarasanga koi. I think we have to end, sorry, late. Time for prasadam. I came here for prasadam, not for... All right. All glories to Sri Ram. Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. All right. Krishna.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Very generous.
your time and your